la Grand Management chargée aux admissions et au recrutement. Mon nom c'est Gillian Nickham. I'll be speaking to all of you in more detail tomorrow at orientation, but I just wanted to come down and say hello. And it's really exciting to see all your faces for those I haven't had a chance to meet yet. Thank you for coming to be part of the master class, and I'm going to pass the speaking on to Professor Moïse of the Center for Intellectual Property.
Bonjour, bienvenue à tous. Mon nom est Pierre-Emmanuel Moïse, je suis directeur du Centre des politiques en propriété intellectuelle, Center for Intellectual Property Policy. Center was actually co-founded by Richard Gold and David Lametti as well. C'est un grand, grand plaisir de vous avoir aujourd'hui pour ce masterclass. Vous allez voir que la propriété intellectuelle est très, très active chez nous. It's a very busy place. Nos bureaux sont au cinquième étage. Il y a beaucoup d'initiatives à laquelle nous vous invitons dès maintenant. Donc, soyez attentifs et surtout soyez curieux. Vous allez voir qu'il y a également une initiative avec Industrie Canada et le centre de recherche cette année et beaucoup d'autres activités. So, without further ado, the floor to Richard Gold. Thanks a lot.
So thank you all for being here. I'm Richard Gold, and as of this morning, I'm also Associate Dean of Graduate Studies, which has nothing yet to do with you, but come see me in a few years. And as Professor Moïse said, I was one of the co-founders of the CIPP. So we're really happy to have you here. This is an experiment for us, experiment for you. You come in a day before you had to. Tomorrow, the dean is going to welcome you officially, so I will just do a small little welcome here. But you're an incredibly talented group. I was on the admissions committee, so I interviewed some of you. I read some of your records. Thankfully, I've reached an age and have two small kids who have wiped out any short-term memory I have. So while I have read your files, I have no idea what they said. So you're starting with a blank slate, which is a good thing. But I know today, and not because I remember, but because I looked, among you, we have two PhDs, 14 masters. We have one doctor who's gone through residency, and we've got people all the way from CJAP, from coast to coast, from around the world in this room today, and you're only a third of the class. So tomorrow you get to meet the other two-thirds who are equally illustrious and diverse. So part of what I want you to get out of today is to enjoy that diversity, which is why we're working in small groups at small tables. I have put you at these tables because you represent a diversity of backgrounds. No one person knows everything about patent law. Certainly at this stage, if you did, then you could replace me. But even the background knowledge. So there'll be people with a science background, people with economics, people with history, people with art history, of sociology, psychology, and I can go on at your table. So learn from each other. That's part of the goal. Being a lawyer is not an activity of a single person. It's the activity of a team. So I won't say more because the dean, that's the dean's prerogative, and you get to hear it from him tomorrow. My goal is a little bit simpler than that. So we have approximately 2.5 hours together. And this is what we're going to do. And we're going to try and stick to these time periods. As lawyers, you'll learn that time is very important. Right? You file an IPO, initial public offering, a day late, and they lose $1 billion. Guess who pays for it? So we're going to try and stick to this time. And it's an ethic I would like to inculcate in you. And as Associate Dean, I'll do the same for the grad students. So I'm going to basically introduce you to what we're doing today, and the first question, which is, for most of you, what is law? Whatever you think law is probably wrong. I'm hoping that you'll start to glean that idea today, but you'll develop it over a few years. That's why it takes you 3 to 4 years to graduate here, because we need to do a combination of brainwashing and exposing you to different ideas so that you get there. And then we're going to look at two case studies that I've been actively involved with. I'm going to try and take myself out of it, but try to share the knowledge that comes out of it. So first we're going to look at patenting of human genes in Canada. So if you don't know what a gene is, someone at your table does. We're then going to have a word from our sponsor, because they're kindly, the Intellectual Property Institute of Canada kindly is going to provide you coffee at 2:30 to 3. And the person, Carmela DeLuca, is a partner at a firm called Bereskin & Parr, so she'll come and present for a few minutes, and then you can talk to her during the break. And then we're going to come back with the second of the two substantive patent law-related issues, which is a combination of international law and patent law. Eli Lilly sued Canada for $500 million a few years ago. That suit is ongoing. We're going to look at it. So that's the general outline. What I want you to do between now and 3:10, so you've got 35 minutes. Oh, by the way, I should introduce the people standing up in the back. They are students who have worked with me, and in one case, I have my research associate who heads a major part of my research project. So they know about the subject. They've done research on this. Some have science backgrounds. Some have politics backgrounds. Some came from CEGEP. Some came from university. So they're diverse in the same way that you are, and one's PhD. So they represent kind of the diversity you'll see. They'll be roving around the tables, just listening in and trying to prompt you if you need prompting. But they may not say anything, they may say something. But please feel free to talk to them, certainly during the break, about what it is that we do at intellectual property and so on. There are folders up here. The person, Carmela from IPEC, will talk to you about it, but those are for you to take home. They're from IPEC. So I have a very simple assignment for you right now. I want you to, from the moment, think about the moment you woke up this morning, in a daze or whatever, until now, all the ways that you have encountered law. I won't define what that means. So I just want you to start throwing these out. And then at 10 after, what we'll do is I'll open up the discussion and you'll provide me with some ideas. So my roving band of colleagues will go around as well and try to prompt that discussion. So what did you see today? What happened in your lives today where you encountered law? Go ahead. So as you probably have discovered already, you could have gone on for hours. In fact, I probably could write an entire thesis about, you know, those first 2 minutes that you wake up and all the laws that are surrounding you. It's kind of arbitrary when we stop, but this will give more time for discussion, both of this and the next sessions. One thing I should tell you that I did not tell you at the beginning because of short-term memory loss is there's a camera there. The camera is, you probably saw it. So it's taking video mostly of here, but also of you. If you do not want to be on camera, let us know. And do not volunteer in the next sessions to be one of the 10 people that are up here. We're going to use it for, you know, clips on the CIPP site, perhaps on the admissions site or other internal purposes, but there will be some, you know, use on websites potentially, just those small clips. No one's going to want to sit and watch people talk for 2.5 hours. So just that you are warned and are aware of that, and just don't volunteer to be the spokespeople that will come up in the next two sessions. So that is out of the way. Okay, so I want you now just to, and this could be anybody, you don't have to speak for your table, but speak for yourself, to identify a law, in quotation marks, where it comes from, why it's binding on you, and who you are. Maybe start off with that, your name and There'll be absolutely zero chance I will remember your name for more than about 30 seconds. I used to actually have a great memory when I was in law school. It evaporated just after I graduated, which is a good thing. Had evaporated while I was in law school, it would make memorizing cases a little bit more difficult, but, you know. So you don't have to worry about me having bad impressions of you. I'm not teaching any of you until next year. I don't teach in the first year program. So you can be, you can say whatever you want, and it will have no negative effect, at least as far as I'm concerned. Of course, the people you should be afraid of are the ones sitting around you, because you're generally young and have memories. So who wants to start? So your name, a law, its source, and why it's binding on you. Come on, you were really active. Someone's going to talk. Yes.
My name is Olivia Lenny, and so the driving code, I was driving today. What was the next question?
Where does it come from? Who promulgates that law?
The government.
Which government?
Well, this driving code is specifically in Quebec, so I was driving here, so the government of Quebec.
Okay.
And
why is it binding on you?
Because I don't want to pay a ticket for speeding.
Okay.
And also the safety of other people.
Thinking like a lawyer already, she has a priority straight. Thank you, Olivia. Others? Perhaps you did drive. Don't tell me the only thing you came up with was driving.
If I go into a business, I have the right to be served. There's anti-discrimination laws that are guaranteed by the federal government. And
could be federal, could be provincial.
Yeah, that's true. There's both. Yeah.
In fact, if you went into a store, just the average store, Dépanneur, which law do you think applies to you? Federal, provincial? That would be a good guess. What happens if you went to a bank in Quebec?
Federal.
Why?
I think banks are covered by federal law.
Right. So jurisdiction matters here. And why is it binding on you? Because the law says so?
Yeah.
That the other people will get a fine if they don't do it? Maybe it's a nice thing to do too? Sorry, Olivia. I pick on you, it's just because, you know, that's my nature. Yes.
My name is Sujin Lee, and the law is having one key per room if you live on residence. And the source is, I guess, McGill Housing. And why it's binding on me, because I can't have a spare key if I lock myself out of my room.
But that's not why it's binding on you. What's to prevent you from getting a second key?
Why it's binding on you?
Why not just go to a keysmith and get another key?
That's true. So why it's binding on you? Why it's binding on me? I didn't think of that.
Could be because you have an agreement with the university that you won't do that, and that you will face disciplinary action if you do. Perhaps. I have no idea. So. Never lived in residence, don't know what the rules are, but presumably somebody could try to sanction you under the contract you have with McGill University. By the way, who's McGill University? You all went to it. You're all going to it. What is it? Okay, so legal persons, where did that legal person come from?
It's just there's a bylaw and then the political people that gather and then start an institution, and that institution, according to the bylaw, becomes a legal person in concentration of the corporation.
In fact, it's a little bit different from McGill. We were established by a royal charter, so from the Queen. But most universities would start differently. Who runs us? When you're talking about McGill University, who makes decisions from McGill University?
It's your board.
Okay, so there's a board. And who is the representative of McGill University in this classroom?
Yeah.
All right, so to the extent that I have some authority, then it's me. Okay, thank you. Other ideas?
I'm Neva. It's the first of the month, so my rent was due. And I guess that's fine. I have to do that rent because I signed with my landlord.
Okay.
Is that to the resident in Oshawa?
Well, when you signed your lease, did you go through the Hedgie?
No, he gave it to me directly.
Okay, so it's a contract between you and your landlord, but how does the Hedgie enter into it?
I guess I've committed to a certain duration or term that I get to break.
Could you decide, you and your landlord together, decide to enter into any term in your lease? Just, you know,
no.
On the first of the month, you're going to hop on one foot. Second of the month, he's going to hop or she's going to hop on one foot. Can you, is there a limitation to what you can do?
Yeah.
Why?
Because I guess the music club wants to set the standards of what is not acceptable.
Okay, so we have legislation that sets up an administrative body, in this case, the Hedgie, and it sets up rules and they're binding language because they're following the legislation, which gives them power. The legislation contains things that you can do and can't do. You cannot have a clause that says X. You must have a clause that says Y, etc. So we can have a law that says that, but also an administrative body established by the provincial government in this case, just as McGill is established by the federal crown to set this up. And so we can create institutions from law that then have lawmaking power. Other things. Then we'll go to new person.
Matthew, this morning I reached the limit on my data plan on my phone, so I forgot which room we're in, so I had to look it up on my right here, and I know I'm going to have to pay extra money for data.
Sorry. One of the hidden costs of going to law school.
The reason that the source of that law is the contract that I signed with my phone company, I believe. That's binding on me. What's binding on me for two reasons. One is that if I don't pay, then that's going to affect my credit rating and affect the relationship I have with the phone company. And I think the source of that comes from the CRTC, the Regulation Building for Telecommunications.
And what's the CRTC?
Organization established by the federal government to regulate telecommunications industry.
Okay, so we have a Telecommunications Act that establishes as part of it a bunch of rules, but also establishes the CRTC. CRTC is given the power to regulate the contracts that various telephone and other companies can establish. And that regulation in terms of price, in terms of the conditions, et cetera, violations of the agreement are all determined subject to applications by the phone company to the CRTC, and they approve it, and then you enter into that contract with zero negotiation. Okay, so it's binding on you because the law says so. You might be afraid of losing credit rating. You may also be afraid that they'll actually take away your service. So different ways that it's binding on you. Other examples? Sir?
Azina, and I guess this morning when I went on LinkedIn, I guess law and privacy and social media.
Sorry,
the laws in privacy and social media.
Okay, so where do privacy laws come from?
I guess from the concerns of people have voice as to their security.
So that might be why we have them, but who actually sets out those rules?
The government.
Which government?
Federal.
Okay, it could be if it's for communications. For other things, it may be provincial. LinkedIn may also have rules through contract. When you sign up to LinkedIn, you're signing up to a contract, so it may have rules on top of those rules. So you're facing a combination of contractual rules that you voluntarily entered into, plus a base of other laws that may be promulgated by the federal or provincial governments. Okay. Other?
This morning I had to take allergy medication, and so instead of taking Benadryl, I took the no-name brand because patents on compounds only last a certain number of years afterwards, making other companies can produce the exact same medication with a different name.
Okay, so.
And that is, I guess, patent law.
That would be patent law. But also, what about the fact that you were able to buy that drug at all? Can I just say, I'm going to sell drug X tomorrow?
No.
would have been a nice source of income, but why not? Health Canada. So we have legislation that doesn't allow anybody just to sell drugs out there. And you have, it's regulated, so you have to go through that process. So patent law applies to that decision, but so does the federal government and Health Canada and the laws that allow them, that even allows it to go on the market. Even the generic has to be approved. Can't just say, oh, well, now the patent's run out, I'm gonna sell this. But it's really too expensive to manufacture Benadryl the same way. I'm gonna change the molecule so it's cheaper. Can't do that, right? So I have to actually go to Health Canada and show that what I'm selling is the same thing as what was in Benadryl. So we have two pieces of legislation that apply. And then, of course, what about the pharmacy? Can anybody just sell these drugs? Might have to be regulated and licensed to be able to sell them. Plus, you had a contract with them to buy the drug, right? You had to go up and pay for it, and there's a contract that you have with the pharmacy. The pharmacy is in a physical place. Who licensed it to be there? What about municipal laws that apply to the establishment of that pharmacy where it is? What about the taxes they pay and how that's calculated? So when you pay for it, they have to tell you how much GST or HST you're paying, and they have responsibility to send that to the federal or provincial governments. That's all regulated. They use electricity, so they have a contract with Hydro-Québec. And that's all regulated, the prices. But they still have to pay it if that comes out of what you are paying them, et cetera, et cetera. Employees that are serving you, all subject to provincial legislation. Terms of employment, restrictions on that, et cetera, minimum pay, et cetera. Other examples?
Adrian, I was trying to watch a video this morning on the BBC website, but I was IP blocked because I wasn't in the UK, so but I'm not entirely sure.
So copyright law.
Yes, it might be British law, but maybe also Canadian law governing ISPs.
Right, so they blocked you based, because they have copyright in Canada, they can effectively find ways to block you through the ISPs. Sir?
My name's Cameron, and this morning I made myself a cup of coffee because I'm not a good morning person. And I used potable water, which is a right that's been guaranteed by the International Charter of Human Rights, I believe. And it applies to me because I'm a human.
Maybe. Not the last part. Well, you're a lawyer. You're soon going to be a lawyer, so people will doubt the last part. Sorry to say. By the way, you have about 8 months to change your mind. After that, you start thinking like a lawyer. It's too late, so just to let you know. I was going to dispute the first one. So there's an international law, the international charter or something out there that says you get water. So what? Is that binding? What can you do with that?
Well,
the
national
government can adopt this. Sure. And what happens if they decide not to? We say, you know, we like dirty water. So it's not binding. What's the meaning of it?
I'd say it's more morally and socially binding. It's kind of a means of pressure on national governments to, you know, comply to international norms. But besides that,
right. So bindingness comes in different flavors. It could be everything from your credit rating being cut off from a service, someone suing you and trying to get money, to moral suasion being wrong. Being more symbolic in its application than actually binding in the sense that if you cross it, something bad is going to happen to you. Other examples.
My name is Shakir. I like to go to Sable Beach, and this morning I read on the news that there's First Nations claiming the land on Sable Beach, so that might affect my ability to rent a cottage or access the beach the same way I used to every summer.
Okay, and so where does that come from? Their rights. Perhaps if they have a treaty right, and if they don't have a treaty right, treaty is a contract between sovereigns. What happens if there's no treaty? I have no idea if there's a treaty. But where would that come from? Where would their rights come from if not from a treaty? Do you want to jump in?
Aboriginal law.
Okay, and what's that based on? The Constitution. So. There's a constitution out there which is binding on governments, unlike international treaties. If they fail to abide by it, a court can tell them, you have to. in respect of our First Nations, we have frequently violated those rights, and so First Nations frequently have to go before the courts to try to vindicate those rights, basing themselves on the Charter. So this Charter is a higher level of document, higher level than laws, because laws that don't conform to a Charter are no good. An international treaty, however, is higher than our Constitution, and yet is not automatically enforceable. It then becomes a question, as we said, in many cases, of moral suasion, as between states or between actors, individuals in the states, going to the government and say, look, you're not conforming to this right. I mean, if we look at Egypt and the trial of Mr. Fahmy and the other two journalists, which can, well, conclude for now, this weekend with a conviction of 3 years imprisonment, clearly violates all kinds of international treaties in terms of freedom of expression and so on. It violates international norms about what you're supposed to do, but what can you do? That's what they did. We have ISIS that destroyed world heritage in Syria, clearly violating all kinds of international rules about the preservation of culture and so on, but what are you going to do? So, is it binding or not? Other examples.
Yeah. I'm Tyson. I wrote an article this morning for a website that I freelance for.
Okay.
And obviously, one thing I would have to be concerned about would be plagiarism laws, so lifting other people's work.
What if you said something bad about someone?
Yeah, well, there's libel. In this particular article, it wouldn't be much of a concern, but yeah, libel would probably be the bigger one.
And where does that come from?
Well, libel laws, I believe that's provincial. I think Quebec has a slightly different libel definition than the rest of Canada. And I guess it would be binding upon me because I'm creating a piece of content within the province of Quebec.
And what would be the basis of that obligation that the province enforces on you in Quebec? How would it be? How would this rule be manifested about libel in Quebec? You said it comes from the provincial government, but how? What are the choices? I expect you to know the differences between Quebec and the rest of Canada yet. In one choice is it comes from legislation. The province passes a law that says you shall not do X. Could also come at judges. So in the rest of Canada, these rules do not emanate from the legislature. They emanate from a long history of rulemaking in the common law. Could be a combination. You have a very abstract rule, which is what you'll find in Quebec, and then it has to be interpreted. And how does it get interpreted? It's up to the judiciary to give meaning and substance to that abstract rule. So when we say the province mandates it can mandate it through legislation, it can mandate it through allowing judges to make up law, it can mandate it by setting up an independent or quasi-independent organization, the CRTC, the Régie, that then makes rules that are binding on you. In fact, municipal governments are such creatures. They have no constitutional status, and they are established under provincial law. The university, as I said, is the same thing, and then it has some rulemaking power. What about those of you who are driving? Well, maybe not driving. Anybody take a bus or a metro this morning? Okay, so if you're at a metro, and there are people on the metro, and you're lining up to get in, how does that work? Do you all just massively collide like it's a big rugby game? But generally, how do you know what you're supposed to do? What do? You generally allow people to get off, and you kindly line up kind of out of their way on the sides, and then you go on in the order in which you were at that door. But that social convention is exceedingly binding on you because you obey it all the time. And does anybody tell you what that law was? You just know it. What happens if you take notes in class and someone else wasn't there and asks you for notes? Do you have to give it to them?
Right.
And if you don't, what happens? Well, Next time you ask for notes, you won't get them. Right? You could be ostracized to some extent. So there is some bindingness to it because your peers will know who you are. I run in my property class, which you may or may not be in next year, have an assignment where people have to negotiate. And on occasion, individual students pull a fast one. Everybody knows about it. Guess what their reputation is, not only in law school, but when you go out into practice. If you know that person will pull a fast one on an assignment that really has no implications for anything, imagine when someone's actually paying them. So your reputation is subject to these social norms. What happens if you are, this comes from my late colleague, Professor McDonald, you're a Muslim woman whose parents tell you you have to wear a headscarf. But you go to a school and in a province or state that doesn't allow headscarves. What do you do? Do you wear it or not? Whichever way you decide, you are breaking a rule. How do you mediate that? And do you really care that one comes from your parents and one comes from the state? Does it really matter? They both are binding on you. Your parents may be able to impose greater enforcement against you than the state in certain circumstances. So these laws that we're talking about emanate from different organizations, but in the same activity. You know, just imagine, the moment you wake up and you have a radio come on, is that radio allowed to be sold? You might see a CSA sticker. How do they put that on it? What about the radio station? It's subject to copyright. What about the music they're paying? How do they pay it out? Who's regulating how you even get that airway to you? Who's got that spectrum? What if they're advertising something and it's false? So in the moment that you're just becoming aware of the world again before you have your cup of coffee, you have you're surrounded by law, and there's no a single law that applies to your situation. Unfortunately, we're going to teach it to you in silos. You're going to learn contract law here and tort law there. But reality is that you're constantly living in a web of hard, that is binding in the sense that there are clear repercussions from the law, and soft, that is moral or peer pressure. You're constantly living in that environment, and you have to mediate it. You have to, as an individual, decide what to do. So if you want to understand law, understanding a statute is of no value because it doesn't tell you that social context. This is one of the things that we're particularly proud of in Yale, is that we focus, of course, none of that got on tape. We focus on that environment. So when you're learning civil and common law, you're learning international and national law, you're learning state-based law and non-state-based, yet it's government or from your colleagues. That's what you're learning about, is how do you cope in that complex world? Okay, that's enough on that topic for today. You've got 3 to 3.5 years to 4 years to figure that out. And if you graduate law school knowing the answer, then you should start again. Right. This is a process that takes forever. The most frustrating thing to any law student is their law is incredibly unclear. You come to school and say, well, just tell me what the rule is. I can tell you 10 rules, now tell me how you're going to deal with all of them and what they're going to mean in this situation or that. So we're going to illustrate that a little bit through the examples. So I'm going to start off talking to you a little bit about patent law, and then I'm going to introduce the case of the Children's Hospital of Eastern Ontario that has launched a challenge to the idea that you can patent a human gene. So I'm going to count on those of you at the tables who have a science background to help your colleagues understand. I'm presuming most of you have an understanding of what a gene is, but perhaps you need a finer understanding. Those of you who have an economics background, business background, may also want to contribute. Those of you who have politics background may want to. Sociology, what does this mean in the world, et cetera, et cetera. So I want all those point of views to come out. So I'm going to give you the shortest version of patent law I've ever given, and you cannot practice. This is like the big warning under the advertisements. Don't try and do this at home. An inventor, so you have an invention. We'll come back to that key word. But I've got something that's an invention, believe me. And I can get a patent by applying in different countries. There's no such thing as a patent that just comes manna from heaven. I have to go out and apply for it, and I do it on a country-by-country level. In some jurisdictions, like Europe, I can get a regional protection. There are some it's a jurisdiction-by-jurisdiction thing, but there are some international mechanisms. I mentioned the Patent Cooperation Treaty here that helps get that internet. So it sets up a process by which I, through a single invention, can get protection in multiple jurisdictions. I still, in the end, have to go to those jurisdictions, but I can ease it. So here's another rule for treaties. It might be processes that make it easier for you to do something, even though they don't give me any basic rights. Whatever the mechanism through which I get a patent, the basic rule is that it lasts for 20 years from the date I first asked for it anywhere in the world. And the thing I can do with a patent is nothing. All I can do is stop you. I can stop you from making it, using it, selling it, or importing it. So if I have a patent on a drug, I have a patent on a mousetrap, all I can do with it is stop you from making, using, selling, or importing it into Canada if I have a Canadian patent. If I have a U.S. patent, the same thing applies there. U.S. patent has no application to Canada. So if I have a U.S. patent, it has no application to what happens in Canada and vice versa. So why do we give these things called patents? The main motivation, and it's changed over history, but we won't go into it, is really to inspire, give an incentive, however you want to say it, innovation. Innovation is a different word than invention. Invention is the thing I come up with. Innovation is a product or service I sell in the market that you actually have available. I can have a million ideas in my head, all of which are inventions, but if they stay in my head, they do you no good. It's only when I get them out to you. So innovation is the thing that changes our lives, for better or for worse. And the other thing it's supposed to do is spur economic growth. My team back there we're doing various studies to actually see if that's true. But let's just accept it as true for today. So how does it do that? Well, it's this promise, by being able to stop you from doing something, it hopefully means I have a little bit of room to operate. If you want to make the thing, I can charge you for it. If no one else can stop me from making it or it's not regulated, I can sell the thing and make money. So it provides me with an opportunity for this 20-year period to potentially make money. Nobody may want it, so there's no guarantee. And that gives me that incentive, that lure, that I will make money may drive me or encourage me to invest my time and effort into inventing. Second, it might encourage other people to give me money so I can do that. Right? I can give them an interest in it. So I have an idea, but I can't commercialize it. I go to a company that has money and distribution channels and so on. They can give me money or they can give me other things that will help me turn it into an innovation. That's it. So it's supposed to be this incentive, and hopefully by doing this, I introduce new products and services that make you more productive, society more productive. That is, for the same amount of investment, we get more out. That's good for the country. It may provide new jobs, or at the very least, it makes your jobs better, right? I mean, imagine when I went to law school and I didn't have a computer, or I did, but it was really slow and big and couldn't carry it to class. Right? I mean, can you imagine going to law school without a computer or having one access or be able to access things online? So it may just improve your life. But a patent necessarily imposes a cost. Because I can exclude you, what happens if you have a better idea than mine? But to do it, you need mine. That is, you want to improve it, and I say no. So I've shut off potential innovation by other people. At the very least, I can charge higher for my product because you can't get anywhere else because I have a monopoly on it. And so I make more money, which means that more of your cash is spent on my innovation than would be in a competitive market. So that's called a deadweight loss. So we lose there too. So there are costs to this. And the idea is, how do we maximize the good stuff and minimize the bad stuff? So if you actually take a course in intellectual property, that's the central question. And all the mechanisms we have to achieve that balance is what takes a semester and potentially years of practice to figure out what is the right amount. Okay. Structurally, a patent is examined on a jurisdiction-by-jurisdiction basis. I mentioned that. And the patent examiner at the patent office will check to make sure that it is an invention, that it's not new, it's not obvious, and it is useful. I'm not going to go through what all these mean. And it's usually not a simple process. I apply for it. It's not like going to law school. You apply for it and either get in or not. It's a to-ing and fro-ing. If the patent office is finally convinced that you meet all the criteria, they will issue the patent office, but someone else can still challenge you. The patent office does not have the last word. Okay, I want you to focus on this definition of invention in Section 2 of the Patent Act. That's what invention means. I highlighted two words. We're going to look at useful after the break. Right now, we're going to look at composition of matter. So if anybody thinks that this is a clear definition that tells you everything that's in it and not, then probably should be in law school. It's almost identical to that in the United States, basically because our legislation is based on that in the United States, but very different than that in Europe, and very different than that in Australia, which goes back to a statute from 1623 called the Monopolies Act. Okay, so CHEO and the long QT. So long QT is a really bad disease. A rare disease, that is, it only affects 1 to 2,500 people. It's still a lot of people who have it. It's actually one of the most significant of the rare diseases, and collectively rare diseases are incredibly significant if you add them all up. If you've heard of an athlete who, top of his or her career, suddenly dying, it is not always, but frequently this. Something wrong with your heart rate and its recovery. It can be detected through electrocardiogram, but we miss 20 to 40%. So the only surefire way to know is by doing a genetic test, and we know what the gene is or the genes are. And we identified them, and so if you have a mutation, then we can start to do something. Very high risk of death compared to general population. But it's easy to treat. If we know you have it, we can take steps that you can live a normal life. So, CHEO case. Launched just last November. There are a number of patents, 5 patents in total, but you can break them down into 2 categories. DNA molecules that are isolated from the human body, so we're not patenting things in you, but isolated, that you would need to be able to tell whether you have a mutation. So the first step is you take it out. So I'll let the scientists at your table explain that. And then ways of comparing your DNA sequence to a standard to see if you have a difference. If you have a difference, it means that you may be at risk. Okay, this is what you have to do. One of you, probably not the science person, just listen. Don't want you to participate in the discussion. Just listen. You can take notes. You don't take notes. Doesn't matter. I'm not going to ask you to report. I'm going to ask you to use the knowledge. The rest of you, I want you to think about this. Whether the person, presumably in a laboratory, who identified the location and sequence and function of a gene ought to be able to patent it. And if so, what should they be patenting it? And if so, is simply isolating it from the body, that is, taking it out of the body sufficient? So go ahead and talk. And we'll reconvene now at 2. I'll ask the 10 people, that is one from each table, who did not speak, who was just listening, to come up here afterwards. So as soon as we hit 10, those people start lining up. Remember, if you want to be on camera, don't be one of those 10.
That's totally
they don't do it in other places, and you don't have to use the power to create it. And they've got
okay, so we're not asking this question. You were supposed to listen, take in what you heard, and now you're going to answer this question based on what you heard. Now, this is going before Parliament. Parliament has jurisdiction over patent law, and the proposal is to introduce a section in the Patent Act that says that. So, Carmela, you're not allowed to complain about it. She's a patent lawyer, so she may have all kinds of qualms about this. But have you absorbed it, you 10? Okay. So, yes or no? And what's your name and yes or no?
Jesse.
You have to speak up so they can hear you in the back.
I would say yes. I would agree.
Why?
The discussion that we had at our table, just starting with that patenting genes shouldn't be a thing. Just going from that, putting it in isolation, that would be the logical argument from there.
We felt like
you're not actually changing something. It's something that already exists in nature. And so can it really be defined as an invention if you're just finding something and modifying it a little bit? We disagree with that from the outset. So I would disagree with this or say yes.
Okay. Yeah. Perfect. Thank you. I'm going to go in the middle now. Your name?
All right, my name is Ellen, and I would say our group has similar thoughts with the first speaker there. And we thought, similar to the real world, just knowing something exists in a certain location, that is a piece of knowledge, and not necessarily something that is innovative that causes something to change from something that is naturally existing. So we would think that the location itself may not be subject to a patent, but perhaps a method of getting to that location could be.
Okay, so we have two votes against. I want anybody among the 10 tables to think that this is wrong. Are you unanimous that we should pass this legislation?
Well, I don't think our table was unanimous, and we switched back and forth.
Actually, you're not bound, by the way, to your tables. You were supposed to be educated by your panel. You are individuals who can express a different opinion. So.
Well, I mean, if we went back to, one thing we did bring up was if we went back to the initial sort of reason for patent laws to exist, which was to sort of incentivize, invention and kind of create an economic incentive out of it. I think the question was brought up about research and how do you kind of incentivize this sort of research, and that, if you do, obviously there are sometimes very, very significant investments of time, very, very significant investments of money that go into these sort of scientific processes, so that there should be some protection given to what you find out, whether that's a complete sort of ironclad patent that no one else can replicate this process or do the lab work, but that there should be some sort of incentive given to this.
Okay. Sir, what's your position, just quickly?
I support that the isolation of the natural.
Okay, so now tell me why that position's wrong. Why your position's wrong, sorry.
The patent is something that is on something new, something that's part of nature, is not something, it's not okay. An invention.
Right, but I want you to argue against your own point of view. Yeah. What's the strongest argument against what you just said?
Well.
Because you don't get actually always get a choice of who hires you.
to isolate genes, isolate populations that cause all the phenomena.
So are you, if I understand you, you're saying this might be a sledgehammer to solve a small problem, and the consequences of doing that are not just for this, but in general, right? Okay. Why stop at isolation? What, this only deals with isolation. So why stop there? Why not go beyond it?
Well, I agree with what my colleagues are saying about genes are a product of nature.
Right.
I don't think that companies should be able to profit from, at the very least, isolation of a product of nature.
Why? Why should they be able to profit from it?
Well, what I thought of when I saw the question initially was, like, you can't sell bought parts by yourself for profit.
Right, but you're not. You're isolating, so it's not in the body. It's taken out of the body. Why isn't that enough? What happens if I come up with, you're going to get subjected to the Socratic method by volunteering, if I come up with, I invented insulin or a new protein that is critical to people with certain diseases, and by taking it out of the body and manufacturing that very natural protein, identical in all respects, not even isolated, just completely identical, it will save their lives. Should I be able to patent that?
Well, in that case, we're talking about a treatment. Here, we're talking about a diagnosis and a diagnosis. And if you have...
But that doesn't say that, does it?
Isolation. Isn't the isolation used for the diagnosis?
Yeah, but it could also be used for treatment.
Right.
Didn't say DNA. So if I isolate a protein that is naturally occurring, but put it into high quantity, insulin, human growth factor, and then package it and sell it to you, this says I can't patent it. You want to get in now?
I think that some isolation is a little vague. You know, this is Holloman's decision proposing some isolation. Some isolation could refer to just identifying the gene. It could also, and you could also make the argument that it refers to using that gene or protein or part of the body or part of nature to for a legitimate, beneficial aim to society as a whole. Whereas just identifying that, that could, it could open the door for people to argue that that's my gene, that's my protein. Anyone who else does research on that has to pay money to me, to my company, which could stifle innovation and stifle research into other diseases that perhaps this protein or this gene, this part of nature, is connected to.
Okay. Sir?
We talked a lot about in our table was that science is usually considered a collaborative sort of field, and that many people who have discovered many genes try, like that, for example, we talked about, I think it was someone in our table was very novel, it's a fluorescent gene, something like that, said that it was discovered, and they were given a Nobel Prize for it, and that they did not patent the gene, but it was then used for other things. And so a patent could itself also inhibit people using other beneficial discovery and changing it up and making it better. And we said, what we talked about was that patenting, even if it's just, especially as a naturally occurring competition, would have the negative impact of stifling other research done by other people, like other governments or other universities, which would not help the situation without making it worse.
Okay. Ma'am.
I'll argue against that argument about stifling other inventions. It is true that you can, if one research institution were to have a patent and be able to invent all they want, it's also true that because of that, it'll give an incentive for other research institutions to research on other genomes and other inventions, and in that way, we'll have a variety of bigger
variety of
genes in the research
part.
Okay.
I'd just like to add that we're all sort of working on the assumption that patents will actually inspire innovation and drive economic growth. But there are different points of view, and we have to look maybe at the empirical evidence side, which I know in our table we discussed the different position that is being discussed in Australia at the moment, which is different from the Supreme Court's decision in the U.S., which is pro-patents. In Australia, there's a movement where they're talking about
removing restrictions. And I
removing restrictions on patents or?
Sorry, removing regulations for patents.
Okay. So yes, there's an empirical question. The empirical answer is we don't know. So, economists, two economists, 1950s, nothing's changed, said if we didn't have a patent system, given the evidence, it would be silly, crazy to create one, but because there's no evidence that it works. But we'd be crazy to get rid of it because we have it because there's no evidence that it doesn't work. Goes either way, right? Evidence is contradictory. Well, I have two more people. Who has it? Two of you haven't spoken. So I'm going to pick on you. I'm going to go back to, is this far enough? Should we go further than not just isolation, but what about the fact that it's the same as a nature? How far do you have to change it? So does this go far enough? Could be taking out silver from a stone.
Right.
Okay, so this actually may be over-inclusive in the sense that it's not sufficiently restricted. We go back to your question, your point that, you know, what does isolation mean and who's going to interpret that? Do we want our judges to figure that out? Are they going to do any better or worse a job at figuring out what isolation means than figuring out what invention? If we just shifted the uncertainty from one word, invention, to another word, isolation. So let's say we actually did think that patents over genes inhibits patient access to diagnostic services. What do you have to do to this? How would you change this then to be more focused on that by taking into account that technology changes? Is there a way to save this to take into your point that it doesn't include taking silver out of a rock or something? So do you have any ideas of how you could fix this? Is there a legislative fix to this problem that would be targeted at human diagnostics and only human diagnostics? Do you have a view?
Wouldn't it have to extend it to a process of sorts, so a cure or something more clinical?
Okay, so do you want to attach it to some type of outcome? Is that what
yeah.
you're saying? So you would save it by it has some practical purpose or something?
Yeah.
Okay. To what extent do you think the best place to fix this is Parliament as opposed to the courts?
Because
when
you go to the courts, it takes a long time for an established rule to become like
Mm-hmm.
Which would have a bunch of, like, 10 different policies in the state that have all of their own courts. I think it would probably be the easiest, simplest way to just provide one national standard as opposed to the courts that can provide different standards to different provinces, as well as different interpretations of what, you know, the charter, whether it applies to this or not. So
okay.
I think Parliament would be a nice.
So, what? Two questions for the rest of you. How do I fix that problem about the courts? Well, I'll start there. How do I fix that problem? 10 different reasons and 10 different provinces. Okay, so you limit jurisdiction to a single court. That would fix 10 interpretations. Of course, you might be stuck with a bad interpretation. What about if I told you, 2002, the Standing Committee on Health at Federal Parliament, looking at healthcare, wrote a section that says we shouldn't patent genes, because, and we never have. By then, I don't know, Carmela, how many patents do you think were issued on human genes by 2002?
Almost all of the ones that have been issued since.
Yeah. I mean, there were lots in the works if they had been issued. So they got it wrong. Do you think your legislatures know anything about genetics? Do you trust them to come up with wording that will actually get it right? What about the courts? When they pass this, whatever legislation they pass, let the technology changes. Now, single genes, not important. We do multiple genes at the same time, and we're soon going to move in the very near future to be able to sequence all disease-causing genes called the clinome. 5,000 genes eventually we'll be able to, and there are some places that can sequence every gene in your body. Does even thinking about this, when we're moving from sort of isolating a physical model, replicating it many times in order to actually determine a sequence, when we move to more numeric ways, other ways, what value will this definition have then? That is, does Parliament lock us into answering a question that's 20 years old and no longer applicable?
From experience from the discussion we had at our table, we had an expert at our table, and listening to someone who's working on genes and research right now, even defining for us or clarifying his opinion of an invention and what does isolation entail was very illuminating and really changed, I think, our perspective and really shifted our conversation on So I agree that perhaps with legislation, with the legislature, that would be helpful.
The other thing to ask is, let's say tomorrow they pass this legislation. Because technology is advanced, most of the gene patents that will ever be patented are in the works or have been issued. What effect will this piece of legislation have on those patent applications? Who wants to guess? Well, that's one choice, but no. Right? Legislation, by its nature, is prospective. It starts on the date you pass it. So all those patents in the works, unaffected by this. Does that change your opinion about whether this is the right answer? So even if you think that genes should not be patented, is this the best way forward? What do you think?
I would say that the law doesn't have any connection to what is actually happening.
So thinking about patent, right? By its very definition, an invention is something we don't know about. If I knew what it was, then it would be an invention. It wouldn't be new. And I certainly don't know where technology is moving. I can guess where technology might be moving in 5 years, but I really don't know, right? We all thought we would have little CDs with our entire genome on it. That hasn't happened yet. We've guessed a bunch of other things that haven't happened, and things that have happened we never foresaw. So when you're talking about something like the Patent Act, which by its very nature is trying to encourage things that we don't actually know, is it possible to do anything but have very broad, vague language and hope that the courts get it right? Is there some middle ground? Do you want to jump in?
Yeah, Well, I mean, I think we had, you know, one of the things that we had discussed in our group is the potential of what if you were to, you know, discover this, make this discovery, this isolation, and then you patent it,
mm-hmm.
and then you basically decide for whatever reason that you're just actually going to sit on this patent, so that nobody else can actually replicate what you've done, but on the other hand, you're not using it for any kind of constructive or beneficial way to people, or even for economic, at least short-term economic. So then we were trying to work out, well, how would you then come up with a middle ground that would allow someone to have, you know, a patent on it, but also be subject to certain conditions, like, you know, you have to use this thing.
Right. So one mechanism, maybe we're talking about the wrong act. We have something called the Competition Act in Canada that regulates how people, including intellectual property, use their rights. Maybe this is not a patent law decision. It's appropriately governed by competition law, which is to ensure we have an appropriate amount of competition to generate new ideas. And if someone sits on a patent in a way that is anti-competitive, we go after them. Now, then we have to get into a whole long discussion that would take another master class to decide what is competition law. So whenever you're looking at a problem, you know, we may give it to you under a silo, but don't assume the answer is there, that legislation can fix it. There are institutional questions, parliament versus courts, courts across the country versus unique jurisdiction in the federal court. What about the education of the judges? Do we want more? There is one judge on the entire federal court system in Canada who has actually practiced patent law. Is that enough? How many of them have science backgrounds? Some, not many. Is that sufficient? So we can talk about who makes the decisions, how they're made. We can talk about alternative means like competition law or other mechanisms that might be available to solve this problem. It's not, even though I forced you to think about it in terms of patent law, maybe the answer is not even there. But as we saw before, A, that's hard to get, but B, possibly, but by the time you get there, national discussions are slow, it takes a very long time. By the time you answer the question, and there are some international, actually, statements on genetics. HUGO, which is an international organization with the Human Genome Project, said you should patent in a way that restricts it. The OECD has guidelines, etc. So there are some international instruments that touch on this, but so far they don't answer it at the very local level because they're not directly enforceable. It requires somebody to make it enforceable country. I'm going to end there just because we're out of time. I want everybody to thank our 10 volunteers, probably just all of them. The next batch of 10 will know. But thank you very much for having participated and being good sports about being put on the spot at the very last minute. I'm going to turn over things as soon as I figure out how to run this thing on my computer. Okay. So we're very lucky, as I said, to be sponsored today by the Intellectual Properties to Canada, and as I said, Carmela DeRuca is going to give us a short talk on IPIC, and more particularly, those of you who are interested in issues not only patent law but intellectual property in general. It's a mechanism. It's not a line to one position or another, practice versus something else. So I'm a member, just for full disclosure. So, Carmela.
Thank you very much. So as Professor Gold said,
Brooks Buckley.
Yeah, it's true. I'm here to talk a little bit about the Intellectual Property Institute of Canada. I'm a member, most people of the patent bar, the trademark bar, the IP bar in general are members. I thought I would start first telling you a little bit about my background. I'm a partner with an IP firm called Breslin Park, and I work here in the Montreal office after I moved here a few years ago. Most of my training was in Toronto. I became a patent agent in 2007, in a Canadian patent agent, that is, and a U.S. patent agent. Sounds good, but it's an actual automatic designation that you just have to apply for. So as long as you pass your Canadian, you become a U.S., adds an extra line. I was called to the bar in Ontario in 2006, and before that, I did a PhD and a postdoc. It was during my postdoc that I decided I wanted to be a lawyer and a patent lawyer. But what I want to talk to you mostly about today is what INHIC is. And it's a professional organization, as I said, for professionals who specialize in intellectual property. Patent lawyers, patent agents, trademark agents, copyright, industrial design, academics like Dr. Professor Gold, and IP portfolio managers. And so we have a lot of people who work in-house in IP firms, and in academia, and at universities, because all of these different corporations and institutions are involved in getting IP and learning about IP. And IPIC really encourages trainees and students to get involved. And so, as I'll tell you a little bit later, I'm on one of their committees, and I've been on several other committees in the past, and we've always had student members. So it's a great thing to get involved with. So IPIC does a lot of different things, and I've just sort of picked a few things from their...
No one has ever told me I'm not loud enough. That's pretty good. Okay. Yes. And it continues. IPIC does a lot of different things. So one of their main things is they're involved in... Do I need to clip that? All right, does that work okay? So as I said, IPIC is involved in a lot of different things. One of their main functions is to train and provide training to both patent practitioners, IP practitioners, as well as students who want to become patent practitioners. So they're involved in administering the patent agency exams and some of the other exams, and they provide a lot of webinars and patent agent training courses, trademark courses. They're involved with, there are some McGill courses that talk about patent law, trademark law, copyright law. But they're also, one of their other main functions is to promote the competitiveness of the Canadian IP system. So they're very involved with the Canadian Patent Office, the Intellectual Property Office. They respond to a lot of consultations, not just from CIPO, the Canadian Intellectual Property Office, but also Industry Canada, and sometimes they sort of provide their opinion even when it's not exactly solicited. But they work with a lot of parliamentary committees. They work with CIPO, and they work at sort of really trying to advance IP. And one of the things that they do that's mentioned here under the information is that they try to promote awareness of IP for technological companies and other people who may be interested in IP. And so they offer with the Canadian Intellectual Property Office a bank of speakers. And so that if someone's interested in learning about IP, they can sort of call up somebody from this bank of speakers and learn more about it. So one of the committees that I'm on and have been on for the last 6 years, I'm now just stepping off because many people have told me I can no longer be on a committee that has young in it, but you know, that's a different...
It's a harsh world.
Yes, it's a harsh world. But it really is for IP practitioners who have been practicing for 10 years or less, and I'm just really at that limit, so it's time for me to pass on to others. But the purpose of this committee, and we've had many students who've participated in this particular committee, is for helping new professionals and students sort of learn about IP and for professionals develop their practice. So one of the other things we do is we do a lot of outreach activities. So these kinds of presentations, we've done them before at McGill and at some of the other universities. We've done webinars to sort of tell people who are interested what IP really is like and what the practice of IP is like. Because, you know, it's one thing about learning what patents are, copyright is, but learning about what you actually do as a patent lawyer, an IP lawyer, can be very interesting. So we do outreach, and we have a lot of networking. So we have various subcommittees that if you were to join IPIC, become a member of IPIC, and were interested in getting involved in one of their committees, this might be an interesting one for you. In addition, we put on webinar series, so you have the opportunity to potentially moderate one of these webinars. We have lots of networking functions. We have lunches in different cities, including Montreal. We do a lot of student outreach, and we participate in one of the IPIC publications, and we submit articles. So you have an opportunity to write something on IP, and we've had student members or non-IP professional members who've contributed. So it's definitely an interesting committee to look into. So being a member of IPIC, unfortunately, comes with a cost, but it's a reduced cost for students, which is nice. So it's $50 a year. But it gives you access to a lot of professional development webinars at a discounted rate and access to their publications. So I don't know if you've published in any of the IPIC, so you could read for free Professor Gold's articles and other articles on very interesting topics in IP and sort of learn where the profession is at and where it's going and what the academics in the profession or the more academically inclined in the profession think. You have access, if you really do decide that you're interested in becoming a patent agent or trademark agent, you have access to the exam prep courses, and there are lots and lots of networking opportunities, both with sort of young practitioners and sort of the bar in general, the IP bar. And as I mentioned, there's a whole bunch of committees that some may not be that interesting. You may not have the background to participate, but there are several that you would more than be welcome to participate in. So the last thing they asked me to just mention is to sort of convey to you my incredible love for being an IP professional. And this is very true. As I mentioned, I did a PhD and a postdoc actually before I went to law school. And interesting that you mentioned Hugo, but that was one of the reasons, sort of this, with the Genome Project, one of the reasons I went to patent school, to law school to become a patent lawyer, because I was very interested with a lot of the ethical issues related to gene patenting, or what they call gene patenting. What being a patent professional, which is what I am, allows you to combine various backgrounds. So if you have a background in an engineering or other technical field, it allows you to draw on both, and it's a really interesting career. If you don't have a technical background, it's not that you can't be a patent professional, but you might not want to be a patent agent, you might want to be a patent litigator, and I'll mention a few other careers that are possible whether or not you have a technical background. What's really interesting about the profession is that no 2 days are ever alike. You meet the most interesting people. Inventors in general are very, very interesting people. And they make for, you can get some really great stories without naming names. And also, you're not just working with patents, although I personally think patents are very, very interesting, but you're actually involved in the business of your clients. So I work very much in the diagnostics industry, and you really sort of see how changes and positions of the various patent offices really affect a client's businesses and whether certain new products can come to market. And so you're involved in actually moving something along, so it's very, very exciting. So as I mentioned, there's a lot of different career opportunities, some that I've mentioned today, patent agent, trademark agent. You can be an IP lawyer, which you'll be, I understand all of you, or many of you are in law school. And you can practice in many different areas, including trademarks and copyright, industrial designs, even if you don't have a technical background. There are IP portfolio managers in a lot of companies, which is also, you know, making sure that your patents cover what your products the products you're hoping to sell. But there's also a lot of jobs in the public sector, including patent and trademark examiners. So SIPO, although they're not hiring probably right now, but they, in the U.S. Patent Office, is always hiring examiners, and it's a really interesting career. And at the universities and various research institutes, there are a lot of technology transfer people, the people who deal with the scientists and help sort of bring those discoveries into a commercializable format. And for those of you who are so interested, judges is also, we need judges that understand IP. There are a lot of consultants in the area, so some people who have technical backgrounds, legal backgrounds. It's always, you know, many of your clients, whether you become a patent professional or not, will have patents, and so it's a good thing to understand. So that's basically it. So I wanted to thank you for your time. There are handouts from IPIC, and some of the things that I've mentioned are included in there, some of their webinar and the membership information. There are a lot of benefits. You get to know a lot of people. And the one thing that I find really interesting about the Canadian IP bar is it's a very, very friendly bunch. Most people know each other and work very, very well together. And IPIC in general does a really good job in sort of getting everybody together for the annual meeting. And even though everybody works at different firms, it is unbelievable sort of how cohesive the bar is. So it's a great profession if you're interested. If you have any questions, I will hang around for a while at the break and happy to answer. Thank you very much.
I should have mentioned this when we were talking about what is law. In fact, we don't only speak English here, we do speak French, so don't feel either in your... Everybody here understands the other language, English or French. At least you said so on your own. We're going to take you at your word. So you should feel free at your table to speak in whichever language, and when you're up here, to speak in whichever language. We know that speaking at least two languages expands your mind.
So you also will have an exercise on Friday through the faculty and integration day to outside of this area. You're actually looking at the Lac Mégantic disaster and sort of legal, social issues that come out of that. So you can have another opportunity to look at how different aspects of law affect a real life situation outside of this particular world. So. As you might get a flavor, this is really important to us, that you're human beings first who use the law. Like a good lawyer, I remember when I was in practice, a good lawyer is not one who says no. Right? You can't do it because of this section of the law, or you can't do that. A good lawyer is the person who figures out how to get to where you want to go. And I want you all to be good lawyers. And that means understanding not just narrow areas of law, but understanding why people want to do what they do. Their aspirations, the aspirations of your clients, but in general, and how do you use the law as a tool to get from here to there? That's what makes a good lawyer. So you have to think about everything. Obviously, you can't deal with everything at once. At some point, you have to reduce a legal problem to particular legal rules. Right? So in the case I told you about before, the break, CHEO, in fact, while they're attacking the idea of a patent, they're also giving the judge a menu, not just saying, well, get rid of gene patents. They're saying, well, maybe they could exist, but you should apply, make it harder to get. We didn't discuss that before, but that's an opportunity, right? You have to meet a higher standard to get it, to make sure it's really inventive. Or read them really narrowly, so that as the technology moves from simple genes to multiple genes to whole genome, it just doesn't apply to that activity. And give the judge the opportunity to decide based on the other arguments that will come from the other side about what the best answer is. So I had to reduce it today to that simple question, should you patent genes? But in fact, that's not even within patent law, that's too limited. You need to think outside the box. What do you want to accomplish? If your goal is, how do we ensure we provide health care to Canadians, I don't only have to do it through getting rid of gene patents. I can do it by making them harder, as I said, narrower in scope so they don't interfere. And so being a good lawyer is thinking about all the ways that I could use the law to get to the real goal, which is very seldom a legal win. It's how do I get a practical win that my client can live with. We're going to move now to another controversy. So we tend in law school to focus on cases and so on. I told you before the break that to be an invention, it had to be useful. You remember the definition. I highlighted the word useful. In fact, that term is not defined in the Act. You're starting to see a pattern, I think. So how do Canadian courts understand that work? Well, they go back and they look at old British cases dating back about 200 years to try and understand, well, what does useful mean? Turns out that I'm compressing history here somewhat. An invention is useful if it does what the inventor says it will do. So 200 years to arrive at this point. And how do we determine this? We determine it through the eyes of what we call the skilled reader, but someone who works in the area. In fact, this is not an obvious answer, right? I could have an invention, and it does something. That could be useful. What happens if it's only found to be useful 20 years from now? Does that make it useful? So, in fact, we actually need a rule. It has to be useful on the date that I apply for my patent in the way I said it was. As long as it does that, and perhaps some minimal criteria, although it's not terribly articulated, then it's deemed to be useful. If I had no idea why it was useful, then it's not useful. We could have another test that says, as long as it turns out to be useful, even if I didn't know about it, it should be patented, right? So let's say I come up with something that makes all of us live longer, but I didn't know that. One could claim, well, I should still get a patent because I introduced it. So we decided, or at least 200 years of case law said no. In fact, more or less, the U.S. rule is if it does something on the date that not I filed it, but that I fight about it, then it's useful. So the United States has a different rule. Europe has the rule, well, if I can make it, or if someone in industry can use it, it's useful. Well, there's lots of things one could make that may not terribly be useful. So here are different articulations of this standard in different jurisdictions. But ours looks higher. Ours looks tougher. Even though you laughed, it's still a higher standard than, well, it does something at some point later. Ours is it has to do what you said. You actually have to know that it does something, as opposed to the United States, which it just has to do something. So how it turns out, though, that while and making it, well, I can make lots of things that are useless, but yet it will be useful. But each of these other jurisdictions have other ways that I'm not going to get into today to try and get at this problem that you actually have to contribute real knowledge on the date you apply. That is, if it's not useful, if you can't articulate why something is useful when you apply for a patent, you probably shouldn't get one. They don't do it through the test of utility. They use other things. Then there are many reasons for that I'm not going to get into. Okay, so that's the background. But under trade agreements with the United States, NAFTA, North America Free Trade Agreement, under the World Trade Organization's agreement called Trade-Related Aspects of Intellectual Property Rights, shortened to TRIPS, we signed conventions, and this language actually comes from TRIPS. It says, a country, i.e. Canada, must accord a patent for any invention, whether a product or process, in all fields of technology, provided that they are new, involved in inventive step, and capable of industrial application. So we use the word useful, but international treaties say, well, useful means, at least for that treaty, the same thing as industrial application, which is the international word. We use a different word in Anglo-American law. We use utility, they use industrial application. So we have a requirement to issue patents in all fields of technology, provided they are useful. By the way, the term is not defined. Eli Lilly, pharmaceutical company, once wrote an exam with Eli Lilly, called them Lilly, and someone thought it was a person on the exam. So it's not. It's a company, big pharmaceutical company based in the United States. I have no idea who Eli Lilly was as a person. Presumably there was one at some point, but it's a company. And they developed drugs. And they developed two drugs, both in the psychiatric area, olanzapine and Zatera. One for, what was it? Heart, and the other one for attention deficit. No, was it glaucoma or heart? It doesn't matter. Two things. Schizophrenia, thank you. See, we have people with some science back there, or some knowledge that I don't. Short-term memory. I blame everything on short-term memory and my four-year-old twins. Don't want to blame it on age, notice. Just four-year-old twins. Okay, so these were previously known compounds. So they're not new in the sense they never existed. We didn't know. We know about them, but we didn't know that they might be tied to diseases. So what did Eli Lilly do? He said, okay, well, I'm just going to claim that they do everything from, brush your teeth to world peace. It's got to do something. So they filed like 50, 60 applications for different diseases for these two molecules. The patent office, and for the most part, they had really no basis, no empirical reason to think that that would work, other than, yeah, it might work. That was about the level of... But two of the... So one for each patent, the patent office was convinced that they did something. Right? Schizophrenia and attention deficit. So the patent office said, okay, I think you've met our utility standard. Remember, the law is that anybody can challenge a patent after. And in fact, one did. And said, at the date you applied for these patents on these two conditions, schizophrenia and attention deficit, you didn't have a really good basis. Nobody who was skilled in the art, who practiced in the field, would say, looking at your patent application, oh, yeah, that makes sense. There just wasn't a basis for it. And this went up to the Federal Court of Appeal, and the court agreed and struck down these two patents, saying it's not useful because on the day you applied, it didn't do what you said it would do. That is, there was no evidence that it did what you said it would do. Right? Because we're going back to that test. It has to do what you said it would do. Well, it didn't. Now, seems like a pretty obvious argument, but it turns out that this was the brainchild of a lawyer on the generic side who started to use, you know, most of the time when this was used, it was used for other industries. It hadn't really been used in pharmaceuticals before, so he came up with the brainchild. Let's use this argument. So around 2005-ish, he started to use this argument. Other people copied it. He had the highest success rate. We didn't do that yet. I figured out if Radomski had the highest success rate. But his firm has one of the highest success rates on our data set. So we know that, you know, he's a good lawyer, at least in the sense that he wins. And other people copied it, and courts accepted the argument. Okay. Federal Court Appeal in 2008. Eli Lilly then said, okay, you've taken away two of our patents. It's worth $500 million in sales. Forget about whether the amount makes any sense or not. Who knows? And under the trade agreements, I have the right, through something called investor-state dispute resolution, to sue the Canadian government for having taken away my property. My property here was the patent. And that taking away by invalidating the patent cost me $500 million. Specifically, and I'm being generous to them, they challenged that. They actually said this law was new. They're just completely out to lunch. But the better way to phrase this is it hadn't been applied to pharmaceuticals before, and so the way it was applied to pharmaceuticals happened after we got our patent. So when we applied for the patent, we didn't know we would have to meet the standard because no one had ever challenged a Canadian patent in the pharmaceutical industry based on this, even though they may have in chemistry or other areas. Also, the patent office gave it to us. So... you know, we were allowed to rest on the fact, rely on the fact that the patent office thought that this was a valid patent. And third, given the utility test in the United States, industrial application standard in Europe, which are different, as I said, this would have passed those tests. Never mind whether it would pass other tests. It would have passed the equivalent of our utility standard. And based on this, you owe me lots of money. Okay, so same rules. One of you doesn't speak, just listens. I'm going to play the same game. You're going to answer a different question than you're doing now, so listen. And I want you to think about two things and how to balance them. One is a firm who has something innovative and has to struggle with the fact that different countries have different rules and what a pain that is and how much uncertainty that causes to them in trying to get global protection. On the other hand, you have a country who, for historical reasons, luck of the draw, whatever, has a patent law, and sometimes thought out, but that's rarely, thought out policy that it's trying to implement that happens to be different than other countries. That country signs a trade agreement that says you have to give a patent in all fields of technology if it is useful. How do we understand that obligation? And should a country have to say, okay, I'm going to give up my idiosyncrasies to accord with, you know, the dominant player in the world, the United States or Europe, and to what extent should they be able to go it alone? So I want you to do that for the next 25 minutes. So, the context is, one of those Court of Appeal decisions that decided that the patent in Eli Lilly was invalid is now going to the Supreme Court of Canada. And you are making an argument to the Supreme Court of Canada. Should they keep the understanding of utility as the Court of Appeal understood it, or should they reverse it, either based on plain meaning of utility, if there's such a thing, or because of our trade responsibilities and what our neighbors do? I'll give you a minute to cogitate. Or maybe not a full minute. I get to legislate just like Parliament gets to decide to change the time I can change it. Okay. So, sorry, you had the misfortune of looking at me at the time I was going to. What's the answer?
Well, what we discussed most was if the standard is different in either country and you're having a trade agreement, then that means there has to be some sort of standard that's the same in both countries, otherwise you're not in a free trade agreement like we are with the
okay.
U.S.
Okay, so does that mean Canada ought to conform to the U.S. law, or U.S. should conform to Canadian law?
Well, we figured the easiest way would be to use whichever one is the lowest standard, the easiest one to comply with, because then that would mean all the patents from the other country would automatically comply with the rules coming from the countries.
Okay. So what would you tell the Supreme Court of Canada? Uphold the Federal Court Appeal or change it?
Uphold.
So keep our more difficult standard to obtain in Canada.
No, the opposite.
Okay, so we should overturn Canadian patents so that if it does something, it's useful.
Yeah.
Even though, okay, let me ask, who else agrees with that position? Always dangerous when I say even though, but yes, okay. Even though, sorry, I should ask your name.
Phil.
Felicia. Good. Phil and Felicia. alliteration, I can remember that better. Even though, as I said, the United States and Europe have measures, but not in utility, to capture people who overclaim, that is, say that it does something but doesn't. Europe will do it through what's called inventive step. The United States does it through another requirement called enablement. We don't have that. We have no equivalent rules to enablement or inventive step. So the repercussion of us doing what Phil said is that these patents will be valid in Canada under utility, as they will in the United States and Europe, but may not be valid in Europe or the United States for other reasons. Does that undermine your argument, counsel?
Yeah.
That is never the right answer to when you're defending a client.
One of the reasons that I thought that, though, was also that I feel like international law right now is so new that we need to give it a chance to evolve. And in order to, like, give it a chance to evolve, we need to experiment with it. We need to take it into consideration, and we need to make adjustments here or there, but we can't just disregard it.
First treaty dealing with patent law internationally was 18. Does anybody remember the Paris Convention, 1864, 84? I can't remember.
Yeah.
Somewhere back then. I might be off by 20 years. Does that change anything? The TRIPS Agreement is signed 1994, came into force, you should know this, January 1st, 1995.
I still think it would be important to, I'm not necessarily saying
Yeah, I asked you to take it into consideration and not to just completely disregard it, because I knew you did agree with it in the first place. I'm not sure if there's specific clauses that they could have agreed with in terms of...
Well, all it said is what I said, which is you must grant a patent in all fields of technology if it is, I'll translate it into our terms, new, non-obvious, and useful, without ever defining the word invention and ever defining fields of technology, without ever defining utility or usefulness.
I think there's value in just continuing.
Okay, so does that, what should Canada do, though, at the Supreme Court level, while this is happening? You're saying we should change our law to conform with the United States. Why?
Because I think that, well, I mean, they signed this agreement to begin, the trade agreement.
Right.
And I'm assuming, and again, it might be dangerous, but that it's a risk, right? It's a risk that you might undertake, especially when you're dealing with the U.S.
Okay.
And probably with Europe, too.
Okay. So we're going to have to get some more voices in. You want to jump in?
Can I ask a question first before saying my piece? What part of NAFTA are they precisely misappropriating?
They're claiming that Canada has taken away properties. Article 11 of NAFTA says you cannot take property away from somebody, or an investment, sorry, away from someone unless certain conditions are met. They're arguing that it's investment. Let's not deal with that. That's a separate legal argument. Assuming it's an investment, they're saying you've taken it away from us. We had it. You granted us a patent, then you took it away.
Okay. Well, I think this company should also know that in Canada, yes, many patents are given, but many patents are also challenged.
Right.
And so this company was challenged from a generic company, which had a very compelling argument. So if their patent was taken away, and the courts in Canada said that, there shouldn't...
Right. But the argument to the Supreme Court of Canada is not whether Eli Lilly should win its trade dispute. That's not what's an issue here. It's that whether the rule about the meaning of utility that the Court of Appeal enunciated, which gave rise to Eli Lilly's claim, ought to be preserved, or whether Canada ought to, the Supreme Court of Canada ought to say, no, Court of Appeal, you got it wrong. In fact, our utility rule is the same in the United States, which would obviously undermine the NAFTA case, because in fact they would have gotten what they wanted. So, I'll point to you because you were looking at me. Very bad thing. I'm now teaching everybody to look at me. Even if you didn't learn it today, you'd learn it soon enough. Right, whenever I ask a question in class, my notes become really interesting.
I know it's nothing. I would argue to maintain the decision on three grounds.
Okay.
First of all, I think the argument that just because there's no precedent for such a for the law being applied in the pharmaceutical company, just because there's no precedent and we haven't done it before, I think is a fallacious argument. Second of all, I think there's an inherent impracticality of changing the standards at this point, given that it would, in a way, I think it's discriminatory against all of the companies that have been playing by the old rules. If you suddenly relax the standard, I don't know if that is, I don't know if that violates antitrust rules, or I'm not comfortable with the idea of, in the middle of development, suddenly changing the standard of burden of proof. And lastly, I think that ultimately it is a privilege to be able to sell your wares in a given country, and it is the prerogative of said country to set the standards for what rules you need to comply with to sell in our country.
Okay, thank you. Those were well presented. Why is that wrong? No, not you.
Oh.
Don't get hurt. So your name is?
Cameron.
And you are?
Alec.
Alec has to argue why Cameron's wrong.
This was wrong because it is a privilege to sell wares in a given country, but the company in question also is protected by a government that has obligations to and with the country that the company is dealing with, and it also benefits from those trade protections. So if those trade protections have been shirked in this case, then it deserves a report. course.
Okay, and what about reliance by other companies? So part of Cameron's argument was that other companies play by the rules and have valid patents, and these guys did. So if we change the rules now, we'd be giving them something at the expense of other companies who went to the effort of developing, I'm expanding on your argument, the knowledge base, the empirical evidence to support their claims, whereas Eli Lilly just gasped. Okay, that's fine. I'm putting you on the spot. I've studied this for a long time, so don't worry about it. Okay. If you're on the Supreme Court of Canada, do you think you... What about the fact that Eli Lilly went around you, went around the court system, and said, instead of letting the law develop in its time, as was mentioned, it should have the opportunity to develop over the course of time, went around it and tried to go to a trade panel, and claiming that the courts did something bad. This is not the legislature, right? The parliament did nothing. This is all by the courts. How would you, do you think that should enter into your decision, that Eli Lilly decided to take this route around the courts and try to hold the courts up and saying your court rules are what's the problem, not what the legislature says?
I don't think so. I think it's their right to attempt to get paid for their losses in any way they can. An international treaty like that, you can't use that as an equity. It shouldn't be held against them. It doesn't make their case more legitimate.
Okay. So let me continue on in the same vein. Should a court decision that is punctuel, I'm not sure what the English equivalent is of that, be the basis of a trade dispute? I'm going beyond the parameters, so I'm cheating. Should we take that? Here was a particular decision taken at a point in time. We haven't let the law evolve to fully encompass. It's only been since 2005 that this came in. And that you should not hold a court decision as opposed to a legislative or an executive decision subject to trade rules. That is, the courts are neutral. They're not out to favor one industry rather than another, and it's wrong to challenge a decision that's purely judicial. What do you think of that?
It's still a governmental action. I don't see why that makes any difference, whether it's legislative or judiciary.
Okay, fair enough. Certainly that's Eli Lilly's position. So who among you else thinks that we should change the law? That the Supreme Court of Canada should just say, look, Court of Appeal, you enunciated a standard of utility that no longer makes sense. We're going to change it. Right? The Supreme Court, this is judge-made law. Even going back two centuries, it's courts who have made decisions, all the way up to the House of Lords in the UK, but a legislature has never intervened. So a court could come along and say, so what, 200 years history, doesn't matter today. We have a different kind of industry, we're in a different environment. What about that argument, that you should just, Supreme Court, don't be bound by these previous rules, come up with a sensible rule, and of course the most sensible rule is the one that is the global standard, that is whatever the United States says. Sorry, what's your name? Kathleen? What do you think about that?
Essentially, I think that it's a treaty that they agreed on, and that because of that, it doesn't necessarily mean that we should follow U.S. law as a matter of jurisdiction. It's not because it's a U.S. company that it should only follow U.S. law. It was in Canada, and thus there should be a distinction made. And in terms of them using the Court of Appeal or the Supreme Court as a recourse, it was a legitimate section of the law. So for the Court of Appeal to make that decision, it was a recourse that was made.
But let me push, go further. Other people can join in. Forget about that. Forget about Eli Lilly. It's irrelevant to Supreme Court. This is a stupid rule. Don't be bound by 200 years of history dealing with mouse traps and the erasers on a pencil. Right, those type of decisions. We're in the 21st century, different technology, we're in a global world, the way things are sold are different. Change the rule.
I just think we have like a trust issue because people in Canada, they trust the Canadian law, mm-hmm. and there's a contradiction between, and this company, they mentioned the international law. So if you have two different jurisdictions that are contradictory, which one passed first, right? Because even if countries sign international treaty, they don't always respect them. So if you agree on the international treaty, you give in over your sovereignty of your own country and your own law. So where's the limit between, okay, I want to do trade internationally, but I still want to respect my own engagement? Because with this type of law, they have an engagement to the other company that, hey, if you present a patent, it needs to be valid. So then if you change the law, it means that anyone can bring up a patent that can be used for anything, and if so, I think it diminished the values of the patent.
Okay.
So that's why I stick with the definition, so that when you give a patent, it's useful, and in our term, so that it has more value than just putting patents on anything.
Okay, so, but how much should sovereignty stop us from adopting a good rule? Maybe the United States and Europe has it right. Should we just, I mean, if we ignore the context in which this arose, right, you're a court of law, you're supposed to come up with the right rule and not pick it, not be mad because they try to get around you, not because Eli Lilly is trying to get something when it shouldn't have, maybe they're evil, right? Who cares? We want the right rule. What do you think?
Well, I think it opens up the possibility of always changing the rule, by that assumption that every time a new industry comes up, especially pharmaceuticals or technology, comes up with innovation, then we have to change the rule every year, every couple of months in order to satisfy needs. The law is never going to be able to catch up to that technology. That's
no.
why the rule is broad.
But should we adopt a rule? Should we stick to a rule just because it's a rule?
No, I think naturally the rule could evolve,
okay.
But not because it is pressured by other states.
Okay, but putting this out, because you're Supreme Court of Canada, again, you're not asked to rule on the NAFTA claim. You're being asked simply, Supreme Court of Canada, the Court of Appeal has taken applied a very restrictive rule, a rule that has never been applied to our industry before, and applied it in all its glory suddenly here. It has all these terrible effects. It brings us out of line with international standards. It's not good for Canadian innovation. It's the wrong rule today. Overrule whatever precedents you have to overrule in order to come down with the right decision, which is happens to be what the United States has. But we're not doing it because it's the United States. We're doing it because that is the standard. And shouldn't we as a country have a conversation with what other countries are doing? And if that is the standard, then perhaps we should ask why we're out of line with it and not comply because we're forced to, but because it's the right rule.
Well, I think then you would have to look at at this point, because we could take a different path than the United States in achieving that standard. So our history and our precedence is important in our national context.
You wanted to jump in, I think.
Well, it seems to me, even if, let's say everyone agrees it's wrong, one of the bases of the system is that the Canadian population has to trust their judicial system. And they... wouldn't it be extremely unlikely that the Supreme Court overturned such a long history of having a particular rule, especially since a decision of the Supreme Court cannot be challenged, right? Any court making that type of decision, the decision could be challenged
on the basis
of the fact that it's...
Let me ask a question to everybody. How many of you, before you came here today, ever heard of this dispute? Okay, so given how few people, not counting my RAs, actually heard about it, how can we fall into disrepute? Because no one even knew that this rule existed, let alone there was a dispute, let alone anything else. This is a technical area of law, like changing tax law or something else, and the only people who care are the patent lawyers. And they're the ones arguing that we should change it. Or the people who get patents, right?
But I still don't understand why it would be a better decision.
Okay. I'm going to argue whatever the opposite is what you argue. That's the fun of being a law professor. Anyway, thank you very much, all of you. Okay, so I'll just do a few closing words before you let you go and you get to go through more orientation over the next few days. But as you can see, I mean, the rule of the courts, the rule of precedent, which you are going to learn over and over again, what does it mean? Does it evolve? To what extent should we force it to evolve? To what extent do we owe allegiance to a rule developed in another era that might not be right? Or that might be right. What about the fact that we do live in a globalized world? To what extent ought we, for ourselves, ought we to choose to conform to an international standard because it makes things easier? To what extent, though, ought we be able to introduce safeguards into our law that we think are necessary to us? So those are kind of the questions that you'll be grappling with, whether in IP law, patent law, or anywhere else. Okay, so thank you very much. I was really expecting about 20 of you to show up, so I'm very happy that I got about a third of the class. I hope it was worth it. As I said, Friday you'll go through a different exercise with many more professors. You don't only have to hear one. And you'll, as I said, around last month, maybe on tape. But basically your next 3-4 years is going to be answering questions that don't have answers. And part of it is, can you articulate good reasons for it? You should be able to switch sides on a moment's notice. In fact, the way to make sure your argument is strong is to be able to make the other argument. In fact, it's easier often to make the argument against you because you know all your weak points. And then you must address them. You also have to understand, who are you addressing to? So in the first exercise, this was addressed to Parliament. What does Parliament know about genetics? How do you present to them, right? You're not going to give them a tome of 50 pages. They're not going to read it. You have to make remarks to them. How do you persuade them that you're right? How do you make them understand the science, technology, evolution in a way they can act? As opposed to the court, which is going to be much more interested in precedent. Should we follow it or not? When do we not? How do we make it evolve? How do we ensure that people respect the system even if they don't know what it says? You're going to make a different form of argument, much more based on cases and examples and analogies and why does the United States do this and how does it counter it? Very much more technical type of argument. You may have to talk to the media. How do you explain to the media why Mr. Fahmy should not have been convicted in Egypt? How do you get that out there and get the public roused to support it? So there's advocacy. If you're a government decision maker proposing the statute, how do you go about drafting the language so it provides flexibility for what's going to happen in the future, but also answers your problem, but doesn't go too far, doesn't open up another can of worms? What kind of institutions will you pick? We talked about courts and legislatures, but we also mentioned before the Régif. To what extent should we have specialized bodies? To what extent the United States has a specialized court for patent appeals, where half the people at least have a background in patent law? We don't, should we? In Europe, the decisions on the granting of patents is made by a technical committee, not lawyers. Is that the better way to go? So who do you put on it? They have different points of view. They understand the problem. Just like around the table, depending on your background, you had different points of view. So picking the people that are making decisions is important too, and the institutions. So all of these go into what you're doing. And when you're doing comparative law, what are other countries doing? Do we look at it in isolation? Do I just look at what utility law says in Canada and what utility law says in the United States? Is that... right, that's what Eli Lilly is telling us to do. Just look at these two rules. The United States doesn't have an identical rule to us. Therefore, we're out of sync. Or do we look at it holistically and say, well, yeah, you don't do it this way, but here's another section that you didn't talk about, not called utility, that does approximately the same thing. How do we compare laws? Do we take into account the different cultures and histories that went into them? How do we take that into account when we're looking at it? How do we compare law as it's written and law as it's practiced? Right? We see very vague language. If you stop there, it doesn't mean anything. Now, the civil code and common law have very different approaches to these issues. Civil law sets out general principles. and they're deemed to be to apply. The common, and if you look at a civil law contract, they're short. They set up basic obligations. Common law is a bunch of detailed rules that are kind of unattached, and you have very complicated contracts that can run hundreds of pages to deal with every eventuality you can think of, except for the one that will actually arise. So that's what you need to master, is thinking about through two different legal systems, common law and civil law, but also you'll be exposed, hopefully, to Islamic law or so religious law. People living in Indonesia are subject to a civil code written in Dutch that nobody understands. Statutes written in their own language. And then ADAT laws, which are the local community laws. And how do you figure out which one actually applies to the situation at one time? We only have to deal with federal and provincial, but you have municipal laws. And as I said, you belong to communities that set up its own quasi-judicial, right? If you have a complaint about Miguel, you're going to go through an internal process. Hopefully you won't ever have to. And then you go through the other system, so you have to understand it as well. Anyway, it's going to be hopefully fun. It'll be very frustrating at times. But you're going to come out of it being able to articulate why things are important. That's the most important. The answer is almost irrelevant. Not relative to your clients. It's how do you get there? So when you're listening to us teach about a case doesn't mean what it decided, the one point. It's how do you use that argument in another context to get where you want to go. It's all about getting where you want to go, memorizing cases, knowing the legal rules, kind of boring. Knowing how to think like a lawyer, so that I don't know if anybody saw, what's the paper chase? Go back and look at it. Kingsfield, the big contract lawyer, standing on a podium, comes in. You come in thinking with a brain full of mush, and you end up thinking like a lawyer. To a certain extent, that's what we're doing. We're brainwashing you to think and articulate arguments in a particular way. Don't get caught up in here's the right answer. If you write an exam and you say here's the right answer, chances are you missed the point. It's how did you get there? Anyway, thank you for coming today. Good luck in your next 3 or 4 years, and I hope to see at least some of you next year in property or whatever other class they happen to give me. Take care.